Good evening. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Tuesday, June 1st, 2010 Carrboro Board of Aldermen meeting. The first item on our agenda at one of our regular business meetings is to hear from visitors and speakers from the floor who have matters that are not already on our printed agenda. Is there anyone who wishes to speak?
Yeah, you
Alfonso,
do.
Alfonso, are you speaking?
Alfonso, come on.
Come on up. Come on up to the podium right here, and that mic, stand right in front of that mic, so everybody at home can hear you.
Can I put this on?
If you like.
So I'm here representing Judith Blau, from a professor from UNC. She's here to do a proposal to Carrboro Aldermen regarding a public forum on immigrants. And she writes, "We are proposing a public hearing on immigrants jointly sponsored by the Human Rights Center and the town of Carrboro. The rationale is that during difficult economic times, Americans are unclear about the contributions that Latinos make to the economy and perhaps the demands that they might make on the economy and social programs. If the BOA supports this proposal, we would like them to decide whether this is a day-long forum or an evening forum. This decision affects how many panels we can have. The following groups and individuals have expressed an interest conditional on whether it will be held or not. John Rebo, Latino Affairs, UNC. Deborah Wiseman, Law School, UNC. Marty Rosenbluth, Southern Coalition for Social Justice, NC Religious Coalition for Justice for Immigrants, El Centro Hispano. In addition, James Farrar would be interested in organizing a panel of engaged citizens. James is active in Chapel Hill Carrboro Public Schools. This panel could also include Grace Repass, outgoing principal of Mary Scroggs Elementary School. Another panel could be composed of experts on Latino businesses, Jim Johnson, Business School, UNC, and owners and managers of Mexican restaurants. Another panel would be composed of the children who attended the after-school program at the Human Rights Center. This would attract Latino residents of Carrboro. Other possibilities for a panel: Latino Coalition of North Carolina, SHAC, Health Clinic, IFC, El Futuro, April Morgan, Food and Nutrition Services, Joy McVeigh, Director of Table. We are now open to discussion."
Thank you.
And I guess I take it that the thrust of the request is, if we were sponsoring this event, then they wouldn't have to pay for use of the Century Center, I think is sort of what it gets down to.
And would probably also give it some more gravitas. And
sure.
I'd like to make one suggestion, that there are other businesses other than Mexican restaurants, I think, that are owned by Latinos in our community, and so maybe we would want to include
some
those
others
as well.
Okay, that's a good point.
And then also, I think Justice United may be interested in.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, it seems to me that in principle, this is something we would want to co-sponsor, but in fact, the proposal from the Human Rights Center is, we could do this, we could do this, we could do this, all of which sound like very interesting ideas. But since there's a lot of work to do to develop a more specific plan and program,
right,
that I think before we make a decision about sponsorship, that we ask them to come back to develop the program and come back to us. And that, you know, we're very interested in it, but I think we need more specificity than is available now. That's at least my feeling.
I think perhaps we could, I'm sorry.
I was going to agree with Dan. It sounds like there are a lot of options that, and asking us to decide on that, and we have definitely haven't done any of the work to know what would make sense. So for us to say an evening versus all day, you know, it would be good if that work could be done and we could get sense of it. And I also wanted to mention the Latino Credit Union. I think wasn't mentioned, but they would be valuable to include.
Mark?
Yes.
I'd also like for us, maybe between now and such a point that Alfonso, you and your group come back with some more specifics, that maybe we get a staff report on, you know, on Abbey Court and where things are since Mark, Mayor Chilton, and Alderwoman Gist did their work last summer. I think that would help us with getting some background on how things have progressed.
I think what you're hearing is that we're very interested, but we need a little more detail. And I think part of what you were doing was saying, well, what would you all like? And we're kind of throwing that back and saying, this sounds cool, but what would you like?
We're not the experts.
Yeah, we're not the experts. You are. So, you know, maybe if you do some more planning over the summer, one of us would be happy to sit in on a meeting, that kind of thing. So it's this is a good lesson in how government moves slowly.
Yeah. Why?
Just a point, and I think you have support from everyone. We would support some kind of program. So as a starting point, you also want to probably figure out an outside date and look at the date, because as you're trying to assemble your panels and your ideas, they'll want to know when it is. So kind of think through that. But I think it sounds great.
Thank you so much. And we'll definitely structure this more, and we'll have a really concrete base idea next time.
Excellent.
And I think those of us who know you are very impressed and pleased to see you further growing into leadership roles in the community.
Thank you. So
keep it up.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you all.
Okay. Is there anyone else here who wanted to speak on a matter that is not on our agenda already?
Well, Mark, can I just go back to what I had asked, if we can ask for a staff report between now and maybe September.
Oh, with respect to
Abbey Court.
Oh, just as a sort of update on the conditions at Abbey Court. That sounds
like a motion.
Thank you for reminding me that you said that.
I'll second
that. It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed. The matter passed unanimously. Okay. We are on to our consent agenda, Mr. Manager.
Okay. Item 1 is approval of the minutes of the previous meeting of May 18th. Item 2 is an update on pedestrian safety at crosswalks. Item 3 is award of a contract for audit. Item 4 is a request to set a public hearing on pedestrian and bicycle access alternatives in the Estes Drive area.
I could call A2.
We have a quick question about
for discussion.
Okay. Is there a motion then for the rest of the consent agenda?
So moved.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded for everything except A2, C2. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
The matter passes unanimously.
My quick question was, it said at this meeting that the TAB had that there was a representative of the MPO there, and I just was curious as to who that representative was.
That was actually, I should have clarified, MPO staff, so that was Dale McKeel.
Okay, all right. I figured it was. Mm-hmm.
He knows Barbara. Right.
Mm-hmm. I guess the only reason I wanted to call this was that TAB's worked really hard on this issue and has shown a lot of initiative, and you know, they did videotaping and all kinds of stuff in that corridor. So I want to move the resolution with the addition that the Board of Aldermen commends the Transportation Advisory Board for its initiative and hard work on this. And I also want to recognize the follow-up by the police department, since those two citizens came in a few months ago and digging into this issue.
I'd like to second that.
All right.
And another thank you. It's just stunning work, really stunning, and it really shows, you know, the tremendous sense of community you folks have to put in the time and effort to do what you did. So thank you. Thank you very much. And Jeff, thank you.
Okay, all those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Matter
Mark, I have one more thing that is actually tangential to this, but this is a good time to bring it up, which is on Saturday, on my way to the farmer's market, I was stopped at one of the police checkpoints where they look at your driver's license and that sort of thing in my neighborhood. And in raising this, let me be very clear that the officers in question were very friendly and courteous, and it was really only a minor inconvenience. But at the same time, you know, citizens ask me, well, why did the police do this? And I don't know the answer. And reading this report later that day, or actually on Sunday, I was like, okay, it's Saturday during farmer's market, and the police, rather than working on pedestrian safety, are doing this. And I'm really not pointing to that specific issue, but I think the motion I'd like to make is that we receive some information on the police checkpoints that are set up in neighborhoods around town and what the value is that we receive from those, just because I don't know what it is, and I would like to.
Okay, I'll take that as a motion. Is there a second?
No one else cares. All right.
Hearing none. We are on to agenda item D1, a continuation of a public hearing on a revised design for Smith Level Road improvements. Mr. Manager.
Yes. Continuation of the public hearing on the revised design for Smith Level Road improvements. This is to continue the public hearing, and Jeff Rubaker, our transportation planner, has some additional information to share with the board before continuing the hearing.
Because that's what they do.
No, but that doesn't, that's not a good explanation.
It's not, but that's their standard operating procedure.
But it's...
So thanks. The report in the agenda packet and this presentation address the questions raised at the April 27th public hearing on the revised design for Smith Level Road proposed by NCDOT. The planning process for improvements dates back to the 1980s. Communications between the town and NCDOT and the currently proposed design date back to last year. So the first part of this presentation addresses the board's questions on April 27th in regards to the following points listed here, and also a few more points listed right here. And then we'll reference the Transportation Advisory Board recommendation, provide one or two additional staff comments, and then there'll be time for our questions. So the first question related to a traffic study of the Berry Hill neighborhood. And basically, here's a map of the Berry Hill neighborhood. It's accessed by two roads, Orchard Lane and Willow Oak Lane. The recent traffic counts conducted by the town in late April and early May show that about 900 vehicles use Willow Oak Lane per day and about 300 use Orchard Lane. So about 1,200 vehicles total coming in or out Berry Hill per day. Berry Hill also has a significant number of students, so school traffic is an important consideration for this neighborhood. For the most recent year for which we have data this specific, which albeit is 4 or 5 years old now, there were a total of 95 students in Berry Hill neighborhood, 42 elementary, 16 middle, and 37 high school students. Of course, now the high school students go to Carrboro High this year. This was before Carrboro High opened. Also, there was a request for data on accidents in the Berry Hill neighborhood, and we have an accident analysis conducted using the last 3 years of reported accident data provided by NCDOT. And during that period, there were no accidents on internal neighborhood
Berry Hill Neighborhood Street. So that includes Manor Ridge Drive, Orchard Lane, and Willow Oak Lane. And I should stress that these are reported accidents, so there's always a chance that an accident, perhaps probably minor, could have gone unreported. The major accidents are, of course, likely to be reported. There were 12 accidents external to the neighborhood, and by that I mean either on Smith Level Road or BPW Club Road, adjacent to the neighborhood, so just those segments adjacent to the neighborhood. Accidents by location. This table shows where the accidents happened. Keep in mind there's a small sample size here. We're talking about 12 accidents in the last 3 years, so we should keep that in mind before we decide if there are any trends here in accidents. Four occurred at the Smith Level Road BPW Club intersection. Five occurred on Smith Level Road between BPW Club and Willow Oak. Two occurred on Smith Level Road at Willow Oak Lane. And one occurred on BPW Club Road between Smith Level and Orchard. Accidents by type, half of the six of the 12 accidents were rear enders. Both collisions, both accidents that occurred at Willow Oak Lane were vehicles striking an animal. And the only left turn accident occurred at the Smith Level BPW Club intersection and involved a southbound vehicle striking a vehicle turning left from BPW Club onto Smith Level Road. Two-thirds of accidents occurred when it was clear. Only one occurred when it was raining. Three-fourths of accidents occurred when the road conditions were dry and three wet. Two-thirds of accidents occurred in daylight hours, and four, one-third, occurred when it was dark out. Accidents by speed. In most accidents, there were, in all but one accident, there were two vehicles involved, and in another accident, there were three vehicles involved. This just has the vehicle one and vehicle two. And you can see that in only two of the accidents was there a vehicle traveling above the posted speed limit of 35 miles an hour at the time of the collision. So shifting right along to the next question, this involves NCDOT right-of-way policy and whether NCDOT can purchase right-of-way but not clear it or grade it. I, of course, can't speak from the perspective of an NCDOT traffic engineer, but looking at NCDOT's roadway design manual, it generally recommends setting right-of-way 5 to 15 feet beyond the construction limits in a roadway design.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was real confused in reading this section. What are the construction limits? Is the construction limit the edge of the pavement?
It's the edge of whatever needs to be done to fulfill the cross-section design. So it could be the edge of the sidewalks or past the sidewalks if there needs to be any grading done. That includes, I believe that is included as well. So in this case, with this cross-section, generally the sidewalks are the farthest out.
Right, are the construction limit.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I couldn't get, I'm sure you're going on with this, but in reading this section, I just couldn't get it to make, I was trying to understand their rationale, but I'm sure that'll come through in this.
Jackie had made a great point. So does that mean that construction limit along the entire section can vary?
It depends on the type of cross-section and what the roadway designers want out of the cross-section. Roadway cross-sections, of course, have a number of different elements. They may or may not have a raised median. They have travel lanes. They often have bike lanes and sidewalks. And NCDOT design guidelines and general roadway design guidelines have certain standards for the width of each of those elements. So, for instance, there's a minimum width of a median if you're going to have a median. There's a minimum width of travel lanes, generally 11 feet, minimum width of bike lanes, 4 to 5 feet, mm-hmm. and a minimum width of the vehicle recovery area, which is the area beyond the pavement where if you don't have a curb and gutter, you need to allow an area for a vehicle that runs off the road to be able to regain control so that they don't, you know, there's less of a chance of.
And therein lies the rub with this project, I think. Yeah, okay. Well,
go ahead with your presentation.
Yeah, go
we'll
on.
Come back to
that
line, I'm sure.
There was another question about the project cost comparison, and this information was provided by NCDOT. You can see it in the memo and attachment D. Basically, the current proposal with 3 or 2 lane divided sections with sidewalks and bicycle lanes is $3.4 million, and the previously proposed with 3 or 4 lane divided sections with sidewalks and bicycle lanes is $4 million. So there's about $600,000 less in the current design as proposed as compared to the previous design. This regards a sidewalk south of Woodcrest Drive. At the April 27th public hearing, there was concern from a resident about needing a sidewalk south of Woodcrest Drive. And as communicated in Attachment D, NCDOT is willing to extend the sidewalk to make what could be argued as an important pedestrian connection between the existing sidewalk on the high school property, which ends about right here, up to Woodcrest Drive right here. So the existing sidewalk is here, and the currently proposed limit of the sidewalk is here. So as I understand it from the memo, NCDOT is open to adding a sidewalk on the western side
through there
to connect to the high school sidewalk. I should point out that NCDOT policy requires, in terms of funding, a 30% local match for all sidewalks for municipalities of Carrboro size, and they've indicated that there might be additional right-of-way impacts to adding a sidewalk in this section, but it certainly is, from a staff perspective, and I'm sure I'm not the only one, an important connection between the existing sidewalk there. In terms of eastbound left turns at Willow Oak Lane, it's estimated about 350 to 400 per day based on the town's traffic counts earlier. And there was also a question about potentially limiting left turns at Willow Oak Lane during certain hours. And that brings up possible issues with how can you enforce that? Is it you need additional resources to enforce it? And generally, the usual situation where you prohibit left turns during a certain time of day is for traffic operations. So you have left-turning vehicles blocking a through lane. If your vehicle's turning left, then vehicles can't go through the intersection. And one example of that in Carrboro is at the main Roberson and Weaver intersection, where you can see right here there is a no left turn sign, LED sign, that comes on at certain times, because if you were turning left onto Roberson, then you might be blocking cars trying to go through on Main if there's a lot of cross traffic.
Jeff, did you get any information from DOT on why, given that there's been no accidents at all at that intersection, they're proposing eliminating that left turn in the first place?
There's some information provided in the memo and attachment.
I didn't see that. Do you know where that is offhand?
It's an email memo, and it regards
attachment D, as Arthur said.
I believe so. But we do have Mr. Mike Mills here representing DOT Division 7, the division engineer, who may be able to provide more information on that. That's certainly an issue that town staff and NCDOT staff have talked about at length. But I think it might be best if it came from NCDOT at that point.
Yeah, this doesn't really, and this refers to some federal document that, I mean, I didn't look. Have you looked at, did you follow that thing?
I did. I looked at that.
Yeah. And did that indicate that an accident like this were in 3 years, an intersection like this were in 3 years, there's been no accidents, that you should prohibit the turn? It seems very unlikely to me.
I think the document is more generally related to on high-volume roads where you have a lot of full-movement crossovers, which is the technical term for being able to turn left through a median. There are some situations where safety is a problem. So.
Jeff, is it because it's just short of the 1,200 feet, is that some of what I've seen in there of the distance?
Yeah, the distance is measured between BPW Club and the Public Works driveway, which is the two signalized intersections. And so that distance is a little bit less than 1,200 feet.
20 feet less. One question. You include the National Cooperative Highway Research Program, and that they have four criteria, all of which should be satisfied before a turn restriction is given further consideration. One of those criteria is left turn related delay, conflicts, or crash frequency should be at unacceptable levels. So considering there's been no crashes.
Well, that specifically has to do with prohibiting left turns during specific times when there's not enough there's no left turn storage. So in other words, there's no separate left turn lane. What happens that, let's say if this were a higher speed road, what might happen is that if a vehicle was turning left in a lane that's shared with left turns and through traffic, then, you know, a rear ender. So that specifically relates to prohibiting left turns at certain times.
So this doesn't apply for exiting out of that neighborhood?
No, that's more directed towards the time prohibition.
And so the implication then is that the standard for prohibiting left turns at all times is lower than the standard for prohibiting them only at peak times.
Right.
It's a concept text sensitive decision.
Well, it seems to me, I mean, I don't want to be argumentative with you because I know that this isn't necessarily your idea, but it seems to me it's the opposite of context sensitive. It seems very context insensitive given the context is. I mean, if we weren't improving the road, would anyone be out here saying we should stop left turns at that intersection? I don't think so. I've never heard anyone say that over the last 4.5 years, certainly.
Jack,
have you heard anyone say that? We should prohibit left turns out of there.
Not in the last eight.
So that's my point, is that so all of a sudden we're adding sidewalks and a bike lane, and now you can't have a left turn anymore. I don't get what the change context is, and I would like to understand that.
Sure. And that's something we've definitely communicated with on a staff level with NCDOT. And I think that they said that might be something they could look at, but I would not want to speak for them to say.
Okay, that's fine. Go on.
Specifically say that. So moving along to the question as to the Board of Education's position on the revised design, they considered it at their May 20th meeting, and they passed a resolution. Be it therefore resolved that the Board of Education is in support of improvements to Smith Level Road to make it more pedestrian-friendly and a safe walking route to and from Carborough High School without the requirement of a crossing guard and without taking a specific position on specific items such as a roundabout. You can find out additional recommendations and attachments in Attachment E. The school board also indicated, if I'm representing them correctly, that they would have to see what the project would be like when it was finished before they would make a decision on extending the walk zone for any school.
So we'll continue having more people driving. Yeah.
Depends on what improvements we make. Mm-hmm. That they may or may not be in favor of.
That they don't have to spring for.
All right, anyway, go ahead.
There's a question about the tree canopy along Smith Level Road. And we just have provided some aerial photos of the tree canopy in relation to the right-of-way. This is between BPW Club and Willow Oak Lane. And you can see the right-of-way, the existing right-of-way right here is about 90 to 95 feet. Here you can see a Google Street View image of that segment. And here's the section further south, kind of between BPW and heading towards Rock Haven. You can see that there's a variable right-of-way width along the distance. And here's a street view look at this section of roadway.
Jeff, on those aerial views, I think when I wanted to see these aerial views, I was hoping we would be able to get the actual construction area, the new easements, the actual delineation of what they're calling for as for, like, taking out trees. And I don't get that from this. And because it was such a significant point from so many people, I think it would be a valuable thing for us to see before we make any decisions. I hope the rest of the board agrees.
Yes. I do have the design on a PDF that I can pull up if we need to refer it to it.
But would it have sort of the live, would it just be two-dimensional lines as opposed to superimposing wherever the easement would be so we could actually see it on the aerial photo? Because I think if it's in paper, you don't get the same sense, at least I don't, that you get if the lines were somewhat drawn on that particular picture.
Yeah, I think that would be the ideal. That's difficult technically to do because the design is done, I believe, with CAD, mm-hmm. and not in GIS.
Oh, okay.
So it's difficult to overlay the design with the GIS image and be sure that you're doing it right and that you're representing it right.
So in the picture, in the Google Earth picture, could we pull that one up?
This one?
Yeah. With the new design, which of those trees would be gone?
I think that would be, I mean, it's difficult to say at this point that would be easier to determine further down the road when there's more detailed drawings.
But it's such a pivotal point.
Jeff, the tree line, that would be moved back because of road or because of sidewalk? It's right away, but
this section right here would be the three-lane section. The section right here.
So it varies.
Yeah, this is the two-lane divided section.
Uh-huh.
I believe there's an attachment in the agenda packet that shows the typical two-lane divided section.
How far is the sidewalk, generally speaking, from the edge of the travel lanes as it's proposed in DOT's proposal?
From the edge of the travel lanes, let me just bring up an image here.
Would it be attachment B2?
I believe so. It should. I can. And I can pull this up on the board right here.
Looks like it varies considerably in that you know sort of representative profile. It has to do with the topography, of course, to some extent. But for example, in the sample, it shows I think 18 feet on one side. And about 13 feet on the other.
Right.
You know, Jeff, I, preparing for this meeting, last week I went to visit Woodcroft Parkway, which I know, I don't think that's DOT, but I got the feeling from folks at the last meeting when public spoke about that concern about the trees and making this project human scale. So I went over to Woodcroft Parkway last week, and I took a look, and it was mostly, you know, single lanes in both directions. They do have a roundabout. They also have a couple of major intersections. And I went back today to look at it, and one of the things that I noticed that I didn't notice the first time is that along several stretches, the sidewalk is inside of a tree line. Is that at all possible with this design,
I wouldn't feel comfortable answering that. I would feel comfortable deferring that to NCDOT on that one.
Okay, fair enough.
But here is the two-lane typical, and it shows an 18-foot distance on the left side between the sidewalk and the travel lane, and that's 13 feet from the sidewalk to the end of the road because of the bike lane. And then on the east side, there is a 22-foot, I believe, 22-foot distance from the travel lane to the sidewalk. And I should point out that this area right here between the pavement and the sidewalk is the vehicle recovery area, and NCDOT has certain guidelines that determine the width of that area if you have a road section without curb and gutter.
Jeff, am I correct in thinking that part of what's driving the distance of the sidewalk from the road is to allow the possibility for future widening of the road without needing to move the sidewalk, or?
I think that at the last public hearing, it was made clear that the part of the influence of the width of this cross section right here is that the feeling to prepare it for a four-lane section if necessary, and that would be something that the town would have to approve before it happened.
Thank you.
Dan, I think if you look at the level at which the sidewalk is and the level of the road, it appears to me that, and maybe this is a question for DOT, that because they're not at the same level, if it came to making that extra lane, I would think that they'd have to tear up that sidewalk and rebuild a new one.
That's a question I wouldn't feel comfortable answering for sure.
Yeah.
And then it would take away the vehicle recovery zone.
There's a different standard when there's curb and gutter. So if there's a curb there, the vehicle recovery area doesn't need to be that wide.
I guess they assume you kind of bump back in off the curb.
Yeah.
And is this whole project without curb and gutter?
This section is without curb and gutter.
Okay. There's parts, I guess, around the intersections where there would be curb and gutter. Is that right?
Yeah, and there's obviously in the median, there's a raised curb there too.
Right.
So.
Okay.
So if we got curb and gutter, we couldn't.
Right. Okay.
So the next point is pedestrian safety and roundabouts. There's a roundabout proposed, of course, at the intersection of Smith Level and Rockhaven Road. There's some more details in your agenda packet, but research has shown that, in general, pedestrians are generally at a lower risk of severe collisions at roundabouts as compared to other intersections. And this is influenced by lower vehicle speeds at the intersection compared to a traditional four-way intersection, a reduced number of conflict points, which I'll show you in a minute, and splitter islands that allow pedestrians to cross one direction of vehicle travel at a time. This can also, of course, be accomplished on traditional intersections with pedestrian refuge islands. This is a comparison of a typical four-lane intersection and an intersection with a roundabout. If you can see here, the dark dots are vehicle-vehicle conflict points. So these are all the points in an intersection that vehicles making normal movements could collide with each other. And by normal movements, I mean typical movements, including potentially illegal movements of running through the red light. And then the light dots are vehicle pedestrian conflicts. These are points where in the intersection where vehicles and pedestrians making normal movements could collide. And the upshot of this comparison is that on traditional intersections, you have twice as many vehicle pedestrian conflict points as on roundabouts. There's more information about that in the memo, but moving right along to the question of pedestrian signal heads at NC 54. This is outside of the scope of this project, but it's close to the project, so it's an important point to bring up here. This is just a map of the intersection of NC 54 and Smith Level Road. And it shows that there are two crosswalks on the east side connecting Greensboro and Smith Level, where there are sidewalks. Of course, on the west side, there are no sidewalks. And basically, pedestrian signal heads, the warrants or the necessity for them is determined by a manual on uniform traffic control devices. And this is based on a number of factors. If crossing is only based on vehicle signals, which you have to do if there's a crosswalk but no pedestrian signal head, if that's confusing, then that's a potential for signal heads. If the vehicle signals aren't visible, so you don't know when which leg of the intersection is green and which is red, that's another indication. And there are certain other factors to consider. It's beyond my capacity right now to say if pedestrian signal heads are warranted at this intersection. That would be a decision that would be best approached with an engineering study. And finally, regarding the possibility of fruit trees in the roadway, NCDOT has guidelines that are available on their website for what you can plant in a right-of-way. And that's available for download at, if you click on the Division of Highways and then you click on the left, there's a publishing/references link, and you can find that there. I think that's better than, you know, putting a huge URL up there that nobody's going to copy.
So does it include fruit trees or not?
There's a long list, and I'm not an arborist. Some of them looked like fruit trees, but I guess I would let somebody else try and eat the fruit before I did. Anyway, there's a number of guidelines, and one of them is plantings must not interfere nor endanger. They must not interfere or endanger vehicular or pedestrian traffic. So if it's a case of fruit trees that deer might like to eat and you're increasing the deer in the roadway, that might be a potential hazard. Or if they're large fruits, you know, like if you want to try and grow coconuts or
then
might be an interesting driving experience. So that is the attempt to address the questions that were raised at the April 27th hearing. I have some slides that detail all the provisions of the TAB recommendation. The TAB reviewed this on their May 20th meeting, and that's included in your agenda packet. I'm not going to go through all the specific points right now, but we have them available if we need to reference them.
Has DOT seen those recommendations in preparation for this meeting?
I haven't sent them to specifically to them, but that's something that I could do.
Okay.
And one final staff observation that I wanted to point out was that one of the things we communicated with NCDOT was to consider putting a pedestrian refuge island in the design at the intersection of Smith Level Road and the driveway for the village's apartments. Basically, what you have right here as a result of the center turn lane and then a right turn tapered lane is you have four lanes of traffic for this very brief segment to cross the crosswalk. And the center turn lane, at least at this end, is not needed because there's no left turn opportunities right here. So we thought that it might be a good idea to consider putting a refuge island, especially considering that within the immediate vicinity of this crosswalk are a number of living areas for older adults who might not be able to negotiate the crosswalk as easily, and that's a 60-foot span right there. So, and that's also in the TAB recommendation as well. So that's
Did you get a response to that?
They said that they would NCDOT said they would take a look at that, but we don't have a definitive response quite yet.
That's a driveway for the villages, right?
Yes.
Yeah. It's in there.
And okay. So then the additional questions.
I'm sure there are many, but we do have a number of people signed up to speak as well.
It seems like we should ask people to speak if they have new information. And, you know, we heard a lot at the last meeting, a lot of good information. So to try and, you know, respond to the new points that are in the report. I think also, I mean, obviously I'm not suggesting we vote on this at this point, but it seems like that there are enough unanswered questions tonight that we're probably not going to make any decision on this tonight. I don't see it anyway. I just wanted to put that out there.
Jackie.
I know there are a couple of people that came here tonight with some illustrative comments to make. And so while I don't feel a need to hear what I've heard before, and I think the rest of you feel the same way, I think there are several people signed up who have some, you know, this is probably a really direct impact on some people's lives. So if it's old information, please trust us that we've heard it. If it's stuff that is illustrative of points people are trying to make, then I'd be happy to entertain that.
Okay. Well, with those two pieces of advice, the first person signed up is Alan Weibel.
And I'm in the Berry Hill neighborhood, way into the neighborhood. And I wanted to bring a little bit different perspective. We've been talking, while we're looking at lines on a map, I'd like to talk looking at trees on land and the actual environment we're talking about. So this is BPW right here, going down Smith Level Road. And there's that hidden turn at the bottom, and all of a sudden you've got FPG Elementary School. So this is the section. I want to make a point here. From here to this fence is 30 feet. This right here is a bike lane. It's not very well paved, but there's a bike lane on one side now. There are three lanes already, two north and south, and that middle lane, which is X'd out a lot of the way, but then there's the turn lane there. So what we've been talking about is already there except for the extra bike lane on the other side without talking about the sidewalks. And one of my things is 30 feet's a lot of space. And that's not enough for the DOT. They want to go much more. 30 feet is a long distance to add two sidewalks and another bike lane. If you go back, right here is that same fence that you saw. Now we're going back into the trees. Jason Toft, you remember the famous 70 trees that are coming out? Here's where they're coming out. They want at a minimum of 12 more feet. So that's 42 feet off the current. And that even comes up to, I guess, about 30-some feet at some point as they make the turn. But if you imagine, all those trees are coming out, and that's going all the way down.
Alan, I'm sorry, where's the road?
The road is right here.
Okay.
If you look this way, this fence, and let me make it easy for you. That's the same fence.
Okay, thank you.
So you got 30 feet. There's the 30 feet, and then 42 feet. All of that.
From that point there, that vantage, there's an additional 30 feet that they want to hold.
And you don't see it so much, but the other thing that you see when you're actually there is the hill coming down. It comes down, I think, over 10 feet. So what they're going to do is push that level area all the way in here, and they need a lot of extra space because they've got to level it out. So they're destroying the backyards there.
Without curb and gutters.
So, yeah, that's what I was saying on that map. You can't see the elevation differences that it's actually there. This is just the BPW entrance on the Smith level, the light. And this is the one exit that we would have if you take the other one away. And now let's go down the hill. This is the other Willow Oak entrance. And you can see already there's a turn lane there. So we've already got the three lanes here. We've got a bike lane on this side, not on the other side.
There's
some pavement.
It's close to a bike lane width. It's about 4 feet. Maybe it's shy foot or so, but... But it's more than...
All right.
Got it? Okay. And now here's Cross the Street. And we talked about coming out of Berry Hill on Willow Oak, that left turn lane, that there is a space for an entrance lane. There it is. It's sitting there right there today. There's a lot of places in town where you have that middle lane where you can go in and out. Space is already there. And I clocked it. For somebody coming up from our end of the neighborhood, do they come out the normal exit here and take a left turn to come into town? It's about 3/10 of a mile. You have to add a half a mile going through the neighborhood, up out through BPW, waiting for that light, coming back down here. Every time they leave the neighborhood to go to town, you're forcing them to drive a half a mile farther every time.
Well, 1 mile.
I suppose they could use the bike lane.
That's true.
We could ask everybody in town to use the bike lanes, if that's what you're saying.
I would like to.
Okay. Well, then we don't need this. And why are we having this discussion? Now if you go to the entrance here, here's our current sign, or our entranceway. We're talking about taking... lots of trees out all the way up the street to add another bike lane and the sidewalks. And if you think about what, I mean, I think we want, this is a residential area, a nice residential area. We're going to take all that out. And all those trees all the way up the street from about here up. And I hope we don't do that. So that's what I wanted to show you. Thank you.
Thanks, Al.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next speaker is Linda Levitch.
Hi, good evening. I'm Linda Levitch, live in Berry Hill neighborhood, 100 Orchard Lane. I won't repeat anything I've said previously, so my only extra point this evening is when you're talking about school children walking to Frank Porter Graham, Colbrook, and Carborough High, none of those children, at least from our neighborhood, would be walking along Smith Level Road because that is not by any means the shortest route to any of those schools. They walk through the neighborhood to get down to Frank Porter Graham, or they walk directly across Smith Level Road at BPW to go to Colbrook, or they walk through the neighborhood and up through the villages to get to Carborough High School. And that's my only new point. Thank you.
Jason Henning.
I'm Jason Henning. I also live in Berry Hill. You have to forgive me. I'm going to read just because I get nervous up here. My comments are new, and they're in regards to the agenda and the information that the Transportation Advisory Board gave out. What I wanted to say was this past year, the Smith Level Road project has been the most tense and frustrating of the decade that I've been involved, but I have to say it's also been the most progressive. We've seen more changes in the last year than we have over the last 20. I did want to take an opportunity to thank the Board of Aldermans for their steady commitment to maintaining Carborough's character and to thank the mayor for his tireless work with the DOT. I'm moving this project closer to what Carborough actually wants. And although he's not here today, I wanted to thank Ed Lewis with the DOT for his patient ear. He's been at all of these meetings that I've been at, and he does sit quietly and patiently and listen to all of these comments. And I have had the opportunity after each meeting to talk to him, and he's very receptive. With that spirit, I'm taking this as an opportunity to basically make public record, to make comment on things. I'd like to look at this as being a new starting point as a two-lane road with sidewalks and bike lanes, and I'd like to comment on some of the recommendations of the Transportation Advisory Board and respectfully request that these comments are fully considered before we move forward. Regards to the Transportation Advisory Board's on recommending the reduction of the footprint to be more attractive, less expensive, more environmentally sound, and it would also save trees and personal property. If the proposed footprint remains, from a personal point of view, it's what impacts me the most. But from a Carborough citizen's point of view, it's what would be most disappointing. The exchange of a tree line for grassy and concrete medians does not seem to be in our character. It is particularly disappointing knowing that it serves no benefit except to prepare for a future road that may not come. Traffic measurements on Smith Level Road has shown a decrease year after year, and I believe that the addition of sidewalks and bike lanes will aid this also. And we certainly should take into account the environmental and aesthetic impact on the decision. As a homeowner, not only does it have a significant impact financially on the value of my home and my neighbor's homes, it will greatly affect the quality of life for my family. Comments in, regarding the roundabout, I don't have any facts or figures on this. It's just that my experience with roundabouts has been when you have ones that are of a very small radius, it doesn't follow the same traffic flow as a larger roundabout. Primarily what I found that has to do with people don't signal the exit of the roundabout because it's such a short span from when they entered. It makes it difficult to predict what the traffic flow is there from other cars, from the point of view of other cars. I don't know if you've experienced this on Mount Moriah Road, if you've gone there. It's a very, very tight, small roundabout. And what you find is that people go on there. If they're signaling to enter the roundabout, their signal's still on, even if they're turning, going around. And I do think that makes it a little bit confusing. So some of the studies that are in there, I'm just wondering if there's any information regarding the radius of the roundabout. There was also some discussion about pedestrian safety, and I have no doubt that it would be safer to have a roundabout than a four-way intersection without any cross signals. But this does have a stoplight, and it has protected pedestrian crosswalks. So I was wondering if there's any information regarding the safety of roundabouts versus protected crosswalks. In reference to the left turns at Willow Oaks, I would like to challenge the need for a median at all. Smith Level has proven to be much safer than the average road that's in North Carolina, with an accident rate of approximately one-third. The Transportation Advisory Board's research has determined that two accidents at Smith Level Road and Willow Oak have involved single cars and animals. I believe the median is unnecessary and actually is detrimental in many ways. Based on the traffic that's going through Berry Hill, which I appreciate that study, what we would be seeing is the traffic on Manor Ridge rising to 240% of what the current levels are. That's pretty significant through a neighborhood. Second, regardless of the cars, whether they're rerouted as U-turn or through the neighborhood, by design what we are doing is increasing the amount of traffic at the crosswalk that's at BPW. That's the only protected crosswalk in that area, and we are intentionally going to be designing this road to reroute traffic to increase the traffic at the crosswalk. Another thing to keep in mind about this median is it creates a protected left turn at the BPW intersection. However, it's not an intersection to take a left turn on the BPW, it's a parking lot. So what we're doing is we're creating a median protected turn for the University Commons parking lot. You'll find that there is no study for traffic or congestion in that area since it does not turn onto a road. And finally, this can be, I'll try and illustrate this, but one of the things that happens when you have the median at that left turn is it shifts the left turn lane slightly to the right. By doing that, the two left turn lanes that are in line are no longer in line, and it actually creates a blind spot for oncoming traffic for left turns. This is in both directions. That's actually taken out of North Carolina Department of Transportation roadway design manuals. It's considered undesirable and less safe than having two left turn lanes facing directly onto another.
Jason, which spot are you referring to specifically?
If you were traveling southbound, well, actually it would be either north or south, the left turn lane at BPW. If you were traveling northbound, the left turn goes onto BPW. If you're traveling southbound, the left turn goes into a parking lot. But what happens is by adding the concrete to the left turn lane that goes into the parking lot, you shift everything over a little bit, and now the two left turn lanes obstruct each other for the visibility. The last thing I'd like to say regarding the median is the DOT states that the elimination of a left turn is necessary based on the crossover guidelines requiring 1,200 feet between the roadways. And there's only currently only 1,020 feet between, I believe it was Willow Oak or BPW, perhaps. It's the public access area. But please understand that this is based on a median being there. In the absence of a median, the NCDOT guidelines between two intersections is 100 feet. So by eliminating the median, the requirements that they have are also eliminated. My final comment is actually just food for thought, and actually it doesn't have to do with this specific project, except for the idea of congestion. As I drive past FPG and we go over the bridge, it's been brought up that the bridge is not the scope of this project and we can't add any more lanes there. But currently, as you're traveling northbound, there's a designated left turn lane to go into the public works, which is rarely used. And I'm wondering if we could actually solve any congestion problems, which is primarily at school drop-off time, about 8 o'clock in the morning when people are dropping off kids to FPG, by simply repainting the lines and having the left turn lane that's a left turn only for public works become a left turn and straight lane, and the lane that is currently a straight or a right turn lane become a right turn lane for FPG. I guess that's all that I have to say. So thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Could I ask you one other question? When you you threw out a number there about anticipating a 240% increase in the traffic, I guess, up at the south end of the development. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. It's Manor Ridge as it comes out by, is it Orchard Lane? As it comes to Orchard Lane.
Where did you get that number?
It's the numbers from the Transportation Advisory Board, the traffic study that was just done. There's 295 vehicles, I believe, at that point, and they're predicting 350 to 400 more. So it comes out to be, it's not a 250% increase, it's 250% of the traffic.
I see. So that's the presumed portion of the traffic, because some traffic will still come through Willow Oak.
I mean, that's what they...
There's a right-in, right-out at Willow
Oak. Yes, but
it's not,
that was
going to be closed.
But that's the number that the Transportation Advisory Board said would be left turns.
Okay. Thanks.
So, thank you.
Thank you.
All right. The next speaker is Terry Buckner.
Hi, I will try not to repeat what I've said in the past. First, I would like to give my sincere appreciation to all of you for the time and the effort, as well as the staff for making this design work for the town, for the neighbors, and for the environment. And I know it hasn't been easy, and you've sat here for many hours with us while we're trying to get it right, and I really do appreciate that. I think we're close to achieving the goal. But I would like to make one request that you request a bicycle and pedestrian safety audit by an outside group such as the Highway Safety Research Group at UNC. In the research that I've been reading on walkability, there's a lot of conflicting information. For example, it will tell you in one place that narrow streets are the safest, and then in another place in the same document, it will say that medians are safe. So there's lots of contradictions, and doing engineering studies is great, but these are children that we're talking about because the majority of the pedestrians are going to be children walking to and from school. And in our Smith Level Road Task Force, we identified over 200 kids that could potentially be walking as a result of making Smith Level Road more walkable. So 200 kids is a lot, and I don't think they always abide by engineering studies. So figuring out what their behavior and what they might understand, some of this stuff we don't know. If we put a left turn, if we restrict left turns at Berry, at Willow, and force people to go up and make a U-turn at the intersection at Culbreth, where kids are crossing to go to school, is that a conflicting? Are they going to behave in a normal and expected way with U-turns? I don't know. The street's going to be wider. Will there be a median where they can get safety? I don't know. But I think that's the kind of information that somebody who's doing a pedestrian and bicycle audit could be, tell us. And so I think that achieves two things. It would assure the parents and the school board of the safety of the design, or assure that we get new features added that would assure the safety. And I watched your response tonight, so I know that some of you at least share my frustration that the school board will not say, yes, these features make it walkable, and before we go ahead and make the investment, rather than and then wait afterwards and we've invested and we're not going to achieve what we want. So I think that's the biggest issue of why I'm proposing this audit. It's a local group. We can get it done quickly, and it's the summer, and they're probably looking for work anyway.
Carrie, just on that, so just because you're on that point, a previous community member mentioned that there's already shortcuts through the neighborhood, and I guess for the Board of Education, one of the issues is for it to be, you know, enough of a shortcut for them to consider it a walkable to school issue.
It gets a little tricky because when we were looking on the task force, there's a shortcut behind Frank Porter Graham that goes to Culbreth, but just because it's a shortcut, it's on private property, and the school board will not consider that for making it a walk zone. So their walk zones always have to be on public property. Mm-hmm. So I don't understand their criteria, and I don't think they have, from what I understand, they don't have hard and fast criteria. So that's the other thing I would hope we could accomplish by doing an audit like this, is establishing a precedence for working with the school board to define what makes a school walk zone prior to us putting in new developments or new roadways, and at least moving that process forward so that there's a partnership between the town and the schools, rather than a guess and fail approach that I would hate to see us encounter here. Because, it's the kids who are going to be walking predominantly here. I know there's some older folks, too, who will be, but again, they're not going to be amenable to engineering studies either. So bringing the social science review in, I think, would help all of us. I got off my notes here, so I need to. I do have one technical problem with what I read in the staff report. On the Woodcrest walk, the sidewalk on Woodcrest, I raised that last not time. And in the report and tonight, he talked about building the sidewalk on the
west
side of the road, which is the high school side. There's already
I thought
sidewalk.
You were talking about the other
there.
Side. Which side were you talking about?
It should be on the east side is where.
West side.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. I'm just trying to make sure we understand.
It doesn't connect. That was that piece.
So it is correct.
Yeah, but Terry's.
But my request was for the west side.
East side.
That's where.
East side.
The east side, yeah.
Right.
So maybe, yeah. The Chapel Hill side, actually. I mean, they should be helping pay for that or support it, because it's the kids from Southern Village coming through that greenway, if we ever get it,
correct,
who would be using that sidewalk to get to the intersection at Rockhaven and cross over. And so I got confused. My recommendation was to look at putting it on the Chapel Hill side of Smith Level between Woodcrest and Ray.
Between Woodcrest and Ray. Is that, so which direction from Woodcrest? Sorry.
Woodcrest is...
south of Ray.
No, no, it's north. So it's in the town limit.
Okay, so you're talking about, where you're talking about is that the, where you're asking for sidewalk to be added is beyond Woodcrest, further, further south than Woodcrest.
You know where they just built that, they put in the, it's not a development because nobody's bought anything, but there's like five house sites right at Ray Road on the other side.
It's opposite Ray on the east.
And that's where the greenway would come through,
okay.
Right around that development. So if we put a sidewalk from there up to Rock Haven, which is Woodcrest, Woodcrest is kind of right across from Rock Haven, isn't it?
Yes, well, a block away.
A little bit, yeah. So it's here. Putting the sidewalks here.
Right, because the, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but because the greenway will come in where?
The greenway, if we can ever get it done, will come in right about here.
Okay. Okay. Thanks.
And I'm hoping that since they're not selling their property too quickly, that will make them more amenable to working. The Chapel Hill, well, the Chapel Hill Rec Department made contact with them or tried to make contact, and they weren't successful. And then I have not been in commission lately, so I'm hoping that this summer, it's a project I have on my list to undertake this summer.
Right.
I don't know whether it'll go anywhere, but I want to try.
Thank you, Terry.
So, thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
And so, could you just before we hear the next speaker, could you just clarify on this issue? What you're saying that since last time DOT expressed some that they were amenable to a sidewalk, additionally where?
Yeah, on the west side.
Point to it on that map, if you would.
So, sorry about the rotation here. Going the bottom is facing north. So we're kind of upside down here, but here's the west side. And NCDOT said they would be open to adding a sidewalk there. We did communicate with them about the east side as well.
Mm-hmm.
And they indicated because the greenway wasn't existing yet, that mm-hmm. there was less of an impetus for a connection mm-hmm. there. And if I understand them correctly, that sidewalk on the east side would have additional right-of-way and potential tree impacts on the frontage by there. So they were open to the west side sidewalk, but as I understand it, they weren't open to the east side sidewalk.
East side, okay. All right, thanks for the clarification. Okay, we have two more speakers signed up. Gregory, I can't read your last name. Pardon? Oh, Dio.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You spoke last. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Good evening. My name is Greg Dito. I'm a resident of Berryhill. Been a resident there for the past 10 years. And certainly several of my neighbors have quite well expressed some ideas that I had as well. I'm not going to belabor some of those points. But I do believe that that we are very close to agreeing to a project that, you know, is more likely inevitable. There's, you know, something has to be done to the road for a number of reasons. I think, though, that the resistance to this road would be greatly reduced on two aspects. Of course, one is the loss of property by our neighbors along the Smith Level Road in the Berryhill Division, and the second is the restriction of left-hand turn lane on the Willow Oak, which is going to cause a lot of, we believe, increased traffic issues. Now, you know, talking about the restriction of the left turn, you know, with the median, of course, the question came up is whether or not the median is really necessary, and the discussion that, you know, enhances safety and it's necessary. I do want to you know, try to pull a few facts together. The accident breakdown for the past 3 years, it should be noted, though, that of the 12 accidents, two, of course, were animals, but only two occurred during morning peak hours in 3 years. Four occurred during afternoon peak hours. All six were rear end accidents occurring on Smith Level. Had nothing to do with vehicles entering or exiting from Willow Oak. And so, you know, you're talking about two accidents over the course of 3 years over a stretch of road that they predict 17,000 cars a day travel You're talking about one accident about every 300,000 vehicle miles in the past 3 years. And so the question is whether or not that really is, that warrants consideration as being a safety hazard, you know, for both Smith Level Road traffic, as well as, you know, for making that left turn onto, off of Willow Oak, and by reason putting a median there. I guess the one thing I didn't realize, though, at the time, and, of course, you know, I became aware of it just, you know, earlier today, is that there would be no curbs on this road. And I guess I would have a major concern if I had a child walking to school at a sidewalk below street level with no curbs. Honestly, I'd want them always be looking over their shoulder. You know, I would be very, very concerned about them walking on a road below street level with no curbs, and on a downhill grade where cars are, you know, can be going as high as 50, 55 miles an hour. Now, that's not usual, but I have, in fact, I'll plead the fifth here, but I have found that cars will travel to 55 miles an hour on that road, and it's quite surprising. You know, it's oddly enough, though, more uphill than downhill, and I'm not sure why that is, but nonetheless, traffic generally is very well behaved, but you will have vehicles that do exceed the speed limit, you know, by quite a bit, and I just don't think that it's a safe arrangement to have below street sidewalks with children walking with traffic without curbs. I also do want to reiterate what was brought before about the criteria for limiting left-hand turns, that one of the criteria is that left-turn-related delay conflicts or crash frequency should be unacceptable levels. I think, as I just mentioned, that two accidents in AM peak hours for the past 3 years, I'm not sure qualifies as being an unacceptable level. And, of course, it says that all four of the criteria must be satisfied, should be satisfied. Lastly, talking about the loss of property, I do have to wonder if it's possible, and of course this is not, I'll show you do this here. Oh, all right. Here we go.
Zoom out.
Yeah. I don't know if I had those little diagonal.
I think you got to use the scroll bars on the side.
Oh, okay. All right. All right.
Right click. You can
click. Just get it on here. Here. Okay. Yeah.
Oh, that is a big PDF.
Okay. What I have to wonder is, certainly, if we consider the necessity for the median, which is 17 feet, whether or not it can be reduced or just entirely eliminated, but also that if you look at, you've got this property on the east side of the road that is pretty much undeveloped property, that I don't see if it's possible to offset the road in such a way that we don't lose as much of the tree line over here, that you can actually still accomplish what you want to accomplish, but you're shifting everything to the west, to the east side, so that you're not disrupting the neighborhoods along the Berry Hill neighborhood. And I realize that, you know, down here it gets a little sticky. I'm not sure of all the legalities and the zoning requirements, but it does seem, though, that there's quite a bit of open land that we could take advantage of versus infringing on the properties on Berry Hill, off of Smith Level. And lastly, going back to the redirection of traffic, last time I mentioned when I was here last about the amount of carbon emissions. Of course, the with the traffic study that the DOT performed, actually, that amount of annual carbon emissions would actually be somewhere in the neighborhood of 35 metric tons per year. Redirecting traffic through Berry Hill around, it's actually 0.59 miles from Willow Oak all the way around down back to Willow Oak on Smith Level. So that would be adding about 0.35 metric tons, but half of that would be in the neighborhood. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. And the last person signed up is Charlie Heilman.
Trip in a long
long time we've been considering this. I'd like to pass on a message from Tom High, who could not make this meeting tonight. He thinks that he very much likes the plan. He thinks that a good conditional approval would be to put in large trees in the cleared area near the sidewalk, and to insist upon that with working with DOT. He thinks that that would enhance the beauty considerably, but it would also make it very hard to reverse in the future if you actually put these large trees in place. People would get used to it, and then in the future, should anyone try to want to turn it into, should DOT come back to you and say, well, let's turn this into a four-lane road, it would be much more difficult to do so. Also, he thinks that it would just remove a lot of the complaints that people have about tree removal in the first place if you start, if you work on trying to get some large indigenous trees in there in the cleared area. Also, I'd like to point out, in terms of the walk zone, there's been a lot of discussion about walk zones. We do a lot of work with Safe Routes to School. There are walk zones and there are non-walk zones, but that does not necessarily correlate with where people walk, where and where students walk. You have areas that are walk zones. That means that there's no bus service. And what that does sometimes is it makes people drive more. So on the other hand, you have areas that are not walk zones, but the kids walk. It's because the parents feel safe about the kids walking. Many times parents want their kids to walk to school. They don't want to drive them all the time, but it's simply not something that they consider to be safe. So when we're working in Safe Routes to School, we're not trying to correlate getting kids to going walk to and from school as to being whether they're walk zones or not. That's a separate issue. That's simply a matter of whether the school board feels that it's safe enough, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the kids are going to walk. It could actually have the reverse effect. I'm the chair of TAB, but I'm speaking as a concerned citizen, not directly for TAB. I think that it would be convenient to judge this proposal in isolation, but the history is a long one, and it goes over two decades. And the first thing to remember, something that has not been brought up that I think is very important, is that the current conditions of Smith Level Road are simply terrible for pedestrians and cyclists. This is not a good place. And the reason why people don't bring it up, I think, is largely they've given up on the road. They just don't think that it's safe enough to ride or walk on. But some people do, and I am one of those people that actually does go up and down Smith Level several times a week on my bike. And there are little paths that people who are walking on the road try to make do getting off someone off the road, but it's a terrible situation for pedestrians and cyclists. That's what we really have to consider, and that's what, when we looked at the last two plans, TAB advised the Board of Aldermen to reject the proposals because we did not think that they were good for pedestrians or cyclists. The four-lane road was hard to cross. It was not good for alternative transportation, and it certainly changed the character of the road completely by turning it into a four-lane road. Now, the latest proposal that we got, we just went over this in 2009. 2010, we get a new proposal from the DOT, and that really did surprise us. And this is a serious compromise that we're getting from the DOT. It's not ideal by any means. And if you look at the TAB's recommendations, we gave a list of things that many of the things that the residents brought up, we also recommended. But it is a compromise, and it's not all our choice. There are things in here that we don't like, but if we're going to get it done, we're going to have to work with the DOT. So I think we have to be honest about the debate. And we have to say this is a compromise for Carrboro and for the DOT. And are we willing to accept the DOT's limitations to gain sidewalks and bike lanes? We may be able to change certain elements of it, but there are some things the DOT may not allow left turns at Willow Oak. They've indicated that in the past, and they may very much not allow it now. And the profile will certainly be larger than we desire. We've indicated that. But what this is, what they're setting themselves up to do is to change it over to four lanes in the future, should it require it. So they're trying to meet us halfway, what they consider halfway. Now, do we work with the DOT? Or, and I think this is a really honest question for all the people that have been speaking previously, do we give up on alternative transportation on Smith Level Road for the foreseeable future? Because I think, to be honest, this is the compromise that the DOT has given us. We're going to have a lot of difficulty getting anything more from DOT in the future. They came a long way to meet us. And we very much thought that we should fight back. At this point, though, in my opinion, we need to work with them. We need to get what changes that we can, but we should understand that there are going to be things that we don't like in this proposal. But if we're going to get bike lanes and we're going to get sidewalks, we're going to have to accept some things.
Thanks, Charlie.
Yep.
All right. Is there anybody else who did not sign up who would like to address the board on this topic right now? Yes, ma'am.
I'm Heidi Perry. I'm also on the Transportation Advisory Board. My comments as a board member you have in front of you. My comments as a citizen, I would agree with Charlie on what he said about the road being completely unwalkable now. I ride it too, not as much as Charlie does. I never recommend to anybody that they ride on that road on a bicycle. And although you asked us not to repeat comments, I see Mike Mills here, so I'm going to repeat them just for him this time. Because I've been on the transportation board off and on for about 25 or 30 years, so I've sort of seen a lot of things come and go. And when I first got on there, it was because the DOT had indicated that Carrboro was going to need to four-lane Main Street, Hillsborough Street, and Greensboro Street, because their 20-year projection showed that they were going to need four lanes. And several people got together and said, that's not what Carrboro wants. They want bike lanes and sidewalks. They don't want four lanes. That's what we got. It's 25 years later. I don't think we still need four lanes on those three roads. So, you know, I don't care what the projections show. I think Carrboro doesn't want to encourage four lanes of traffic. And I know that both Ed Lewis and Mike Mills have been very receptive to suggestions. I would hate to see this project go away because we can't reach a compromise, but I think it might be worth asking one more time if they could reduce the footprint slightly. I think it would be a better project.
Thanks, Heidi.
All right. Dan.
I guess before getting into any specifics, it seems to me that it would be helpful, it would be helpful for me at least, to be able to frame some questions that were specifically to DOT. Because, you know, as Jeff was going through his presentation, he was like wanting to defer again and again. Mm-hmm. And I think to list our questions like we normally do for our own staff and give DOT time to prepare a response and send someone back to meet with us so we can have some conversation on specific points, I think would be very helpful. And so I guess my first question is whether that's possible in terms of thinking about where we go from here with this.
I think it's a good suggestion, Dan.
Steve, is that workable as far as you know? Or?
What's our remaining meeting schedule look like in this summer? If I can.
Yeah, well, next week is a work session, the discussion of the update of the hazard mitigation plan, engineering site plan review process, and the recruitment process for the clerk. June 15th. the adoption of the budget, minor modification for the Ballantyne CUP, report from the Friends of Bowling Creek on the Bowling Creek restoration project, and status report on the Bowling Creek Greenway, update on Safe Routes to School, NPDS stormwater permit renewal, and report on the bike and pedestrian facility improvement alternatives around Estes Drive. And then June 22nd would normally be for public hearings, and right now there are two continued hearings and two new hearings, and then summer break.
And then we meet again in August 24th or something?
Right. August 24th would be the next meeting date.
Okay. I just wanted to get that sort of context.
Right. So we might choose to come back to this in September.
I think it's a really good idea to compile, you know, the list. I think having Mike here tonight is helpful because he's kind of gotten a flavor for the kinds of questions we have, and it gives Mike and DOT a chance to kind of mull through how they would approach, a creative solution from their side. I think the compromise that DOT has come up with, is great. I feel like there's still room for some forward thinking on this, and so I'd like to be able to create the kind of time for us to have these secondary questions answered and for DFT to be able to respond. So if that's a motion.
I'll second.
Before we come up with the questions. That's fine.
As far as that's what our procedure is going to be.
Right.
Staff, you have any, or DOT, have any comment on the timeline issues?
Are we looking at coming back in September? Is that what I'm hearing?
Mm-hmm. I mean,
at the soonest feasible date, but it sounds like our June meetings are all pretty busy.
I guess I'd look to you, Mike. With September, is that doable?
Yeah, I think right now we're not in any kind of timeline to say we've got to have a date by this date. I think what it does is whatever, if Carver decides, yeah, we want to do this project, from that month, we need to add about 8 months to that before we can start right-of-way acquisition.
Okay. Would that also allow enough time to maybe look into Terry's request to have UNC folks take a look at it?
Are you suggesting you'd want to delay it further? If it
No. I'm saying make the recommendation to have the bike and safety audit, or at least present it to UNC to see if...
Ask town staff to approach the Highway Safety Research Center, basically, about that possibility. Is that what you're suggesting?
Mm-hmm. I'm assuming there's some charge for that, which...
Well, if we can find out what the charge was.
I mean, that's normally the kind of thing we would refer to staff for their recommendation on whether to pursue it or not.
So
why don't we refer to the staff and ask them for their recommendation about it?
It might be cost prohibitive.
It might be just kind of thing
might
that some graduate student
some
is itching to do.
Well, some intern.
I'll include that referral in my motion.
Okay. Thank you.
As a friendly amendment.
And the seconder.
Are you?
Okay.
So we'll vote on that and then get to
questions. Yes. Okay. So all those in favor of that procedure, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, matter passed unanimously. So now we are going to move on to the subject of developing some specific questions that we wanted to relate to.
I have a bunch.
Yep.
I had a feeling.
Yeah.
Good.
Okay.
You go first.
Well, I think the first question in my mind is the question I was pressing Jeff on about that left turn out of Willow Oak, and why, if it's safe now, we're improving in a way the road in a way that would make that unsafe. I'd really like that explained, and also in the context of the point that was brought up, that we're actually sending a lot more traffic to the BPW intersection where there is going to be a lot more pedestrian movement, and so in fact, in a place where there has been accidents over the time period in question, it seems like there may be something a a little backwards there in terms of safe grants. So anyway, so that's my question, broadly posed in terms of the that decision, its impact on the other intersection. The other thing I think we're all very interested in is this question of the amount of clearing. And at the last meeting, I asked about the possibility of acquiring the right-of-way but not doing all the clearing at this time, and I still haven't heard an answer to that. And I've since then come up, so I would like to include that question on the list. I had another thought since then in terms of the sidewalks, because a big part of the width of the project has to do with this point of placing the sidewalks far from the road so as to allow possible expansion in the future. And before I put this on the list, I think I have a question for you, Mike Brough. Is it possible for us to enter into some kind of agreement with DOT that if they agree to build the sidewalks closer to the road so as to require less clearing, but if within, say, hypothetically 20 years, we requested a road improvement that would require reconstructing the sidewalk, that we would pay for it? In other words, that we would be giving them an assurance that we would take responsibility should a decision on our part require them to rebuild that sidewalk in the future.
I guess I'm inclined to say yes, or at least that I don't know any reason why we could not enter into such an agreement with them.
Okay.
I've not researched it or anything, but I don't know why we couldn't.
This is a new point.
So then the question is, would DOT be willing to entertain
that? Right.
I'm sure they would.
Share the point. I mean, depending on, it looked like from the way that the relief was that the sidewalks may have needed to get replaced anyway if they were going to do that extra lane. So the question being,
well, that's what Jeff said in response to my question was that.
Oh, but.
Go ahead.
He suggested that it would be for in his hypothetical, that it would be for a period of time, and I think it might reflect the useful life of the sidewalk is sort of,
right.
Which I don't know how long that is, but would be one logical way to do that.
To frame it.
I had a question about the, in terms of the vehicle recovery area. And
can we stay on this point? So
yeah.
I just have one more thing to add to the list. But does anyone else have a comment on, I mean, are people interested in that idea?
It's worth finding out.
I'm interested. My only concern is what the cost will be in 20 years, but since I don't.
Well, except we're all operating from the assumption that we're never going to do that. But
yeah.
Anyway.
Well.
Then the only other thing I would add to the list that I'm thinking of at the moment is, I don't think that we need to, I think TAB came up with a good list of excellent points, and I don't see any need for us to winnow that list, but just to present that to DOT and ask for a response.
Ask for them to respond to each of the DOT,
the
TAB
correct.
Recommendations. Okay.
And the reason I interrupted with that is that the vehicle recovery area, I'm also wondering about the relationship between curb and gutter that maybe the town of Carrboro, could be involved with, and the vehicle recovery area, because it seems to be if you have curb and gutter that you don't need that vehicle recovery area. Is that correct?
When you say, you piqued my interest when you said the town of Carrboro involved.
I'm just wondering. I mean, there's certain areas, along that stretch that if it had the curb and gutter, it wouldn't need to take the vehicle recovery area.
But somebody's got to pay for that curb and gutter, and right now we are having difficulty finding the 30% for the sidewalks.
The curb and gutter, and I think also that's part of DOT's sort of efficiency issue with the whole situation is the prospect of putting in curb and gutter that may later be ripped out.
Okay.
But sorry, we'll come back.
I just think that exploring what we can do with that vehicle recovery area, if anything, is important.
I agree. Lydia, and then Jackie, and then Joel.
Yeah, just quickly, I too also want to thank DOT for the movement toward this project. I see Mike every month at the NPO meetings, and several times in public I've talked about how much I and I know the board appreciates some of the changes we see here. I had a quick question for Jeff. I know we saw the picture of downtown, but do we limit left turns anywhere else? I don't know if Jeff's or Trish or yeah. Do we limit left turns by time anywhere else in town?
I don't believe there's any area outside of downtown where that's the case.
Okay. All right. Well, I just, you know, Mike, you've heard all the folks here talking about this left-hand turn, and just would appreciate DOT really examining that and thinking through that coming out of that neighborhood.
Jackie.
Maybe my question has been answered in part, but it just seems to me that it would be cheaper to put in curb and gutter than it would to go through the expense of buying the additional right-of-way. And it would even be cheaper 20 years from now, you know, to put in the curb and gutter, rip it up, and expand if that's what they want to do, than to go through the expense of buying that right-of-way. So I'd like to see the differences there. I'd also like to see, is it possible to reduce the median or get rid of it? And really, because I think there are really some very well-intentioned and much better informed than I am people working on this issue at DOT. I'd just like to know if DOT has any suggestions for how to cut down the footprint and save the trees. You know, how can we do that? Because I think it's really getting very neat, but the line of people whose lives would be very negatively impacted, their quality of life and the value of the property, that's my major concern now, and it just seems like we've come so far, there's got to be an answer to that kind of last problem. So that would be the thing I would like to see addressed.
I had one more. Did you?
Joel was up.
Okay.
I'm going to pass because the median and the...
Was asked.
Right.
Okay.
And everything else that's been
Sammy,
asked.
Sammy, did you?
I agree.
Had a big old list here.
I would like...
guys must have been...
I know it's the two different programs. Maybe there's a good possible collaboration with DOT and town staff for that overlay of trees, ideally with the new footprint, the reduced footprint, if that's possible. We would greatly appreciate seeing.
Is it possible to can we get it? You're saying can we get an overlay of the construction drawings versus the aerial photograph?
The actual area that would be cleared, along with the photograph of the trees.
And Jeff or Mike, maybe this can be answered now. But I've always wondered, as well as Greg, about why it's not possible to shift further east on that section that's actually on the slide right now. It never made sense to me.
In the past, you said it's because the utilities are there and it's more expensive to move than by right away.
If I could answer,
Sure.
When we had the public hearings years ago, we had a corridor that we had to fall in, and so all of our permits and everything, all the purpose of me, all the documents are based on standing inside that corridor. If we start shifting it now outside the proposed right of way, we're starting over. Mm-hmm. Going back, getting a new document, starting the whole process over again. So I want to suggest we shift into alignment.
Got it. Gotcha. Thanks.
Okay. All right. I think between Sarah and me, Pardon?
Do you need to take the
No.
Well, no, just go wave that because we've heard it before.
No.
So I think we've heard that 32-minute diatribe before.
It was good.
It
was good.
So interesting.
Mark, I've got 9 items on this list.
Okay.
I can provide some clarification on a few of the questions asked, too.
Well, these are questions for DOT.
Yeah, we don't need a response right now from staff, but I appreciate it. So do you want to read your questions or what?
No, what I've gleaned is 9 items.
Oh, yeah.
I just want to be sure that we went through them.
The tab has got 9 items on it. Is that
right? Well, the TAB was just one of them.
Plus all of that, yeah. So TAB, one of your 9 is the TAB.
Not one of mine, one of ours.
But a part of your count.
Exactly.
Of 9, 10 through
17.
Okay.
Okay, I think between my notes and Sarah's, we'll probably have it all.
But you could give a copy to Sarah just in case, too.
Yeah. Sarah's got the tape also.
That's true.
Yeah. Oh, and yeah, I mean, if you have the list, absolutely.
Okay.
Nobody puts anything on tape anymore, Dan. But anyway, she's got the digits.
He knows what I mean.
All right.
Functional core.
I think where that leaves us is moving on to the next agenda item.
Yep.
And we anticipate we'll be taking this back up in September.
Thanks, Jeff. Good work.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thanks for coming.
We don't need to vote on that list of questions. No. Just understood.
I don't think so. I don't hear any. I mean, there's not any debate really about it. So.
Mark, we're taking a stretch break.
Yeah, I think two things. I came here not feeling very well tonight, but I felt this Smithville Road item was very important, and I'm afraid I'm going to have to excuse myself for the rest of this meeting if our Mayor Pro Tem can step in for me.
Sure.
So we're going to wrap the gavel and have a 4-minute break, and then Mayor Pro Tem will preside from there.
Is this the last
one? Everybody want to be excused, no. Mr. Mayor, so you don't vote affirmatively on everything?
Oh, yeah. I trust these guys. No, I guess I should be excused. Is there a motion to excuse me?
So moved
and seconded that I be excused. All those in favor signify by
saying aye.
All those opposed, manifest unanimously. All right, we are on a 4-minute
and
break.
don't you get lost.
With that concession,
I can help vote, Sammy.
Andy Hewitt O'Donnell sitting in Mayor Pro Tem for Mark Chilton, who is not feeling well and needed to leave. The matter before us is the discussion of Orange County's no-fault well replacement. Mr. Manager, did you?
Okay. Willie Best, an assistant county manager for Orange County, is here. I don't think Willie has any kind of formal presentation, but he's here to respond to any questions that you all might have. And in your packet, you'll note there is a response to some information you all had requested from Frank Clifton, Orange County manager. So, again, Willie's here. Come on up, Willie, in case of one.
Board members, questions?
Do you have anything you were going to present to us, or do you just want just here to answer our questions?
Just here to answer your questions. I know it was a question about the 3,000 feet perimeter, which I think the manager responded to, and the use of general funds as opposed to having the enterprise run from the landfill used to pay for any wells that may be contaminated. I guess the only thing I would add to that is that any well that has an issue will be evaluated by the health department, so they'll make that determination. And apparently all this, I'm sure from Frank's response, you can see that all this was based on American Stone Quarry with the 3,000 feet perimeter, so it's just a number that was selected back then in 1999. And the manager felt that since 1999 that we were all in agreement when this thing was put together. We would just ask your concurrence in the adoption of this resolution, just in case.
So you don't have the information on why 3,000 feet was
No, from my understanding, talking with the planning director, it was a number that was selected during that time when the permit was issued to the American Stone Quarry. So it could have been 2,500, it could have been 5,000, but they chose the 3,000 at that point.
Okay.
I don't know if Craig was
and
here.
I'm correct also then that it's not being asserted that a landfill and a quarry have the same impact, but rather that, well, that number's out there and we'll just use that as an established standard.
Right, they may not have
perspective. And that right. it could be a very different impact.
It could be a very different impact. Okay. A very different impact.
Other questions?
Well, is it the if I understand it correctly, the well has to fail first?
That's right. It would have to fail, and that determination would be made by the health department. So anyone that has any issues would make that concern, voice that concern, or legitimize that concern with the health department, and then they will evaluate it.
Well, I think I was one who raised the question about the 3,000 feet, and I just was really didn't know where it came from, and even seeing what was in the packet today, it's, you know, it would be nice, I guess, to have a better understanding of what an actual perimeter was that had meaning in terms of the landfill. But I could also understand that A, might not be possible, and B, would in and of itself possibly be somewhat arbitrary. Mm-hmm. Which you'd have to like come up with, you know, what are really the criteria, since there is no direct impact that we know of, right?
Right.
So I guess I'm okay with this.
Yeah. Sammy, you okay? You look like you're studying that.
Oh, I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
I guess this kind of goes to the what you talked about, the use of the landfill revenues.
Mm-hmm.
Pardon me?
The enterprise.
Right, to go toward the no-fault replacement of all the well of the wells of the people in that perimeter. Is that something that I'm assuming that your attorneys looked over and everything? It seems like an appropriate use of those funds. I don't mean it's not inappropriate, but that it's a use that can be used from those funds.
Right. It can legitimize the purpose, the use of those funds. When we actually started talking about this in terms of the manager and the staff, we really didn't want to use any general funds because there may be some wells out there that are not even related. And once you set that precedence of establishing money coming out of the general fund, which is technically illegal to fix somebody else's well, you're using public money to correct a problem that really wasn't caused by the landfill. But in this case, since the general area surrounds the landfill, the enterprise fund could be used for that particular area that surrounds the landfill.
Is that enterprise fund then typically used for landfill type related expenditures, activities, or?
From my understanding, this was actually set up for this particular purpose, for any contaminated wells. In the beginning, should some had occurred, I guess, back during the years when this agreement was agreed to by all the bodies that looked at it. That was my understanding.
I think Mike was around at the same time, and I'm sorry Mark didn't feel well and had to leave. My understanding and my memory is that it was something that was within the realm of possibility. That not necessarily that it was happening, but it was within the realm of possibility that the landfill could possibly affect the wells. There were other things that could not be done because it just wasn't within the realm of possibility that you could relate that directly to the operation and the existence of the landfill. And so when we were looking at options, this was one that made sense, you know. And frankly, it's probably easier and cleaner to say, okay, 3,000 feet, we're not going to contest it, than it is to contest every well that fails within 3,000 feet, because you're going to get evidence on both sides of that, and the process could be so drawn out. And it is possible that the landfill was affecting the well, and I think that's where this is coming from.
I have one other question. I know you all up in Hillsborough are very cautious about how you spend money, and I'm wondering if you looked at the question of, you know, my understanding is that geologically, I guess, there's a sort of plume from things that might move out of the landfill toward other properties, and did you look at the question whether it made sense to perhaps in one direction or certain directions have the 3,000 feet and maybe have a narrower perimeter elsewhere, or is that again just too complicated?
No, we didn't consider that at this point. However, we knew that I guess between Carver and Chapel Hill, some of those properties are already annexed within those limits, so some of those services could possibly be provided, I guess, water and sewer from
people. Also, the town doesn't provide water and sewer services. That's Owosso. We're not
okay.
In business.
Owosso. Okay. Okay.
All righty. There is an attachment A.
Okay. I'll move attachment A.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Thanks for coming down.
Thank you, Willie.
Thanks for hanging around.
Thank you for sitting for so long.
We had a meeting tonight, too.
So.
Yeah, we did.
Thank
you. Good night.
Thank you. Okay. See, next up is the update on energy activities.
Yeah. The purpose of this item is to update the board on recent staff activities related to energy and sustainability under two topics: the result of a community survey related to climate protection and the ARRA submittals to the State Energy Office and the U.S. Department of Energy retrofit ramp-up program. And Randy Dodd, our environmental planner, has a presentation for the board, and then there's a resolution that we'd like for you all to consider after that.
So there's really sort of two themes of what we're going to talk about tonight, and one is climate protection, and the other, although they're obviously very closely related, and the other is energy planning. I want to just mention, and it's in the staff memo, the details, that we have completed a survey that was broadcast to the community. on getting input to help us with our climate protection campaign. And so all those details are in the staff memo. I'll just very briefly mention that. And the staff has also been pursuing some stimulus-related activity related to energy, and there's really two topics there. One is called the Retrofit Ramp-Up. It's a solicitation that was put out by the Federal Department of Energy, and I think we'll want to talk about that for a few minutes. And there's also a federal money that was passed through the State Energy Office under a program called the EECBG Energy Efficiency Community Block Grant Program. And we are a community that does not receive formula money because of our population size, but we were able to compete in a solicitation for some funds they made available for just for our municipal buildings. And so I'll just very briefly mention that. The survey, the climate protection survey, has been available online, and there's also hard copy materials that were distributed, the same information. We started back on the International Day of Climate Action back in October, and we were hoping to finish fairly quickly, but we wanted to extend the date of the surveys to try to get a little bit more response, and we did get some, but we still didn't get as much as we had hoped for. We did advertise in a variety of ways on multiple occasions to try to get the word out. Perhaps part of the lesson might be that we just our survey was a little bit too long, and people weren't willing to take the time to complete it. We included both specific questions to get as objective and quantitative response, as well as open-ended input to allow people to provide write-in response. And that's all compiled in the staff memo. And we received 56 responses. I'm not really going to try to summarize that. There was quite a varied response, and I think it's just in the interest of time. Staff will be glad to answer any questions if reading through the material you had any questions about the responses. But we just provided it verbatim as it came in. There's a little bit of interpretation in the staff memo, but really we just wanted you to see the community response. In terms of the Energy Efficiency Community Block Grant for town buildings, this is just a summary of the budget. We submitted this back in January, and total project value for retrofits for basically lighting and HVAC retrofits on our buildings, which were the activities that would qualify under the criteria they set up, came out to about $90,000. And it's broken out all here. The recent news on this is that the State Energy Office has just provided a list of communities that would receive funds from this round of funding, and Carver was not included in that, unfortunately. We haven't received official notification from them, and we don't have additional information on if there's, exactly why we didn't make the cut, so to speak. So I'm unfortunately can't give you additional information at this point. It's so possible
this all of this is not happening at this
right.
time.
This was our budget, but as of now, it hasn't been funded. There's been some talk there might be another round of funding under the same program. There's no formal announcement at this point in time, but we just wanted you to know that we were trying.
And this is all stimulus money.
This is stimulus money. Yes.
Do you know how many towns did get received?
The list has been posted. I believe there was, it was eligible to both municipalities and counties, and it was several dozen. I don't have an exact number.
Good.
It's very competitive. There wasn't a lot of money, and there was, basically all the small towns and all the counties in the state were competing for the same pot.
Right. Yeah. It would be interesting to see if you can, and I guess the question is it a public record that we could get a copy of, just some of the looking at to see what was successful in terms of what the successful candidates were planning to do and the amount of money, I guess.
They have sort of general summary information about that posted currently, and it's possible we can get additional information.
I think that might be helpful.
How much was were we affected by the fact that Orange County didn't qualify for funds because of the status of the wealth in the county?
Well, etched in my memory the exact, I think there might have been 100 points, but I'm not positive about that. And there was 10 points reserved for that you had to be in an economically disadvantaged area to qualify. And that was all you needed to do. So we automatically lost 10 points because we weren't in that category. And it looked to me like a lot of the recipients were places that weren't quite as well off in terms of their overall economy.
Mm-hmm. They could probably look at them and see if they are, for economic development purposes, are they a first tier or second tier or third tier community? And then that might give us some indication of the selection.
The savings column, are those annual savings in energy?
If they
dollar, the second to last column is dollar, thousands of dollars, and then the last column is kilowatt hours.
Okay, so by the total of that spending, which is what, around 90,000, you said, we would say have saved, what, 10,500?
About a year.
That's like 10% return annually. Okay. I guess.
Now that would have been the federal money. Federal and town, that 90,000 is, you know, we have both federal.
Right, includes all three of those columns.
So our total match was a little bit under 10,000.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess I'm just thinking about that, if we could come up with those funds, that's a pretty good return on investment, for the town, if we were able to do it ourselves, to say nothing of the environmental benefits, but. I know we don't have money right now, but something to look at. I don't know if it's something we can do, have like a bond issue to pay for this sort of thing.
We've got to pay for our side first.
I know Chapel Hill has energy bonds for just this kind of purpose.
It would only make sense if there were something significantly beyond this added to it. It would cost more money to issue debt for something like this than it would be worth.
So it's too small amount.
Yeah, but I think before we do anything else, what we'd like to do is see if there's going to be another round, because I'm going to propose that we continue to hold in reserve our match money so that if we have another opportunity, we don't have to scramble to find the match money. And we haven't given up yet on the possibility of getting some funds to do this.
Great.
Good idea.
How's your work?
Yeah.
Okay. So second topic under the stimulus program for energy efficiency, the town learned back in the fall of a program through the U.S. Department of Energy that they were calling the Retrofit Ramp-Up Program. This is basically building retrofits and working at a community scale. So very different from what we were just talking about. And this was a national competition, and a very short turnaround. The proposal was due in early December. We had about a month from when it was released to when we submitted it. Our legwork at that time suggested that the best opportunity we were aware of was to partner with Chapel Hill and to work with an organization called the Southeastern Energy Efficiency Alliance to go in on a collaborative proposal for this money. And we did that. To let you know about our efforts back in December. And this proposal turned out to be successful. And we haven't yet received the details of a contract to negotiate with the Department of Energy through the Southeastern Energy Efficiency Alliance, but we have some preliminary information about some possibilities, and just want to talk about that for a minute. Now, this is a list of all of the municipalities that participated in that proposal. And you notice that there are several with asterisks that are indicated as tier two Chapel Hill, Carrboro are in the tier one. That just means we're likely going to be able to respond a little bit faster, and these other communities have a little bit more legwork to do to get to the same point. But we're all sort of in the same boat on this.
So I guess that means that we're not going to go on a fact-finding mission to the Virgin Islands anytime soon.
just Randy and me.
Okay.
I was just going to point out that look at the company of those other, the population of the other cities there, and look at, you know, that's really
we're the smallest
some great
town.
Legwork and some great work our staff
yeah,
has done.
Great really. Job.
Thank you. We're right up there with the big boys.
Yep. And we're hoping we're maybe a little nimbler than some of them, and maybe that'll help us as we move forward. This is what we believe at this point in time. Like I mentioned, this is all still being figured out. But the best guess is at this point that in the first year of this 2 to 3 year program, there'll be two allotments, 6 months each. And the second will be contingent upon reaching specific milestones in the first 6 months. Our funds during this first year will be both to establish this program and to implement it, to get money out into the community, to provide incentives. So both of those are eligible. In year two, however, we're going to focus a little bit more on the implementation end. Hopefully the program will have its feet under it. And there will be a cost share leveraging requirement during that year. Southeast Energy Efficiency Alliance is going to support all the communities in a variety of ways. I won't kind of walk through this, but I think this is a significant offering that they're providing with all sorts of managerial and technical support and great resources. They really seem to be an outstanding organization that I think will benefit considerably from being able to partner with them. And so our recommendation tonight is staff have been able to meet recently and talk about this, and we think our revolving loan program is a good thing to build on initially to launch this and just really to add this energy efficiency piece to it. We're also recommending that we focus on commercial rather than residential because we think we can get it going quicker and it has a higher likelihood of success, and then expand the program in year two and beyond by working with our partners to best serve the community. And we're very fortunate here tonight to have Steve Morgan available, and Steve works with Clean Energy Solutions, and I was going to turn it over to him, he's really an expert on this, and I can introduce him. But first, I want to see if you all have any more questions for me before doing that.
Just a quick question. I know it said Chapel Hill and Carrboro, so is it a joint like fund we're working out of, or is it 50-50, or is it?
Yeah, we're partners in this, and our proposal and our collaboration is in a partnership. And at the same time, we will be receiving separate allocations. The best guess at this time is that Carrboro may be receiving $75,000, Chapel Hill may be receiving $150,000 for a total of $225,000. And we've had some conversations with Chapel Hill staff about whether there's any possibilities for some collaboration in what we do, and there's some efficiencies in managing our budgets.
Like, for example, we're focusing on commercial, but they may or may not make that their initial focus, right?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's because of the revolving loan fund, right?
Right.
And these funds restrict, I understand in North Carolina, revolving loan fund monies for these purposes are solely, you can only use like the federal stimulus funds. Is that accurate or not? I was talking to Jeff Hughes from UNC Environmental Finance. Are these those same funds? I'm sure you all have done the research.
I'm looking at Matt because Matt went to a meeting up there and he's shaking his head no. So that would be a question I prefer to defer.
Matt, before you answer that question, I just wanted to go back briefly to the greenhouse gas emission inventory. I wanted you to finish your presentation. And I understand that over the summer, staff will be looking into achievable emissions reduction target, and eventually in the fall come back and share with us the findings. I just want to point out that, for one, the aggressive target as described by the county's greenhouse gas emissions is based on what was viewed as feasible or achievable is the term they used, whereas the scientific consensus is talking about something that's way more aggressive. I mean, the Orange County one's even lower than what the president's asking for, and he's talking about something that's way below what scientists are saying. So I would hope that over the work in the course of summer that we look at the resolution that we passed as kind of where Carrboro is seeking, as opposed to the greenhouse gas emission forecast and inventory, which is very outdated.
Okay. Yeah.
Should we make a, or is that clear in our resolution? Our resolution states that,
that's what our resolution
does. That give us direction, the resolution we passed on?
I mean, I can just say for myself that, you know, as staff, we've been working under the assumption that's the board's position.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's pretty clear.
Okay, cool. So. Good. Great. Thanks. And so I guess the question was whether the funds are applicable to revolving loan.
Yes, they are. They're federal funds, and I believe we're on solid ground to fold. It'd be a separate piece of our current revolving loan fund. It would be strictly for energy-related projects for local businesses.
But so you'd be creating an energy directed revolving loan fund.
Right. Based on our current model, and the idea would be to use the same essentially the same mm-hmm. process that we're using now,
right,
and try to expand it later. To do more now would make it very difficult for us to meet the target dates.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
And I just wanted to, during our legislative breakfast, I approached our representatives to see about PACE financing, and I'd just like to thank staff for choosing this route, because apparently that route is being held up now because Fannie and Freddie Mac are saying that they don't want property assessments tied to these retrofits, because they feel like the assessments will be that more harder to sell because of the extra cost burden.
We've been tracking that as well, and that's why we've recommended. I mean, we think that might be a viable route at some point in the future, but for moving this money out quickly in the near term, we'd like to stick with something we have a lot of confidence for.
Cool. Thanks.
One final point is we are prepared to, in the next couple of weeks, to try to pull some information together into a draft program design and budget, and can give you a chance to look at that before your summer break. And so that's our intention at this point.
Right.
You know, Randy, every time you're working on something, it's just so clear that what you're doing is what you really believe in, and it's not just part mm-hmm. of your job, and that always comes across. And we're really lucky to have you, and thank you for all the care
True.
And passion
I'll
you bring
that.
To it.
I'll say.
Thank
yep.
you very much.
Yep. Yeah. Absolutely.
So if the time is appropriate, I'd like to introduce Steve Morgan. And Steve works, he's the president for Clean Energy Solutions, and he's been working on this exact topic for many, many years, and helping other communities around the country work on energy efficiency issues. He's helped kickstart energy alliances in several communities, and he's actively working currently with the Southeastern Energy Efficiency Alliance, and he's also working actively with Chapel Hill. I've included a page of bio information about him that I hope you all can get a chance to read at some point, that I'm going to elaborate on all those credentials, but we're just very fortunate to have him. He's also a local resident, and has been very generous in sharing his knowledge with us over the past 6 months. And so without further ado, we'll see if Steve has any additional ideas for you. I'm sure we'll be glad to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks
for being so patient.
I want to echo your comments about Randy. He's a very special person, as are his colleagues that I've been working with. So it's a pleasure to come here. I've lived in Chapel Hill for 15 years. My office is in Cambridge, Massachusetts. So it's nice not to have to travel to come to talk to a town meeting. A few comments about what Randy said. I'm going to go back to the energy efficiency block grant because you were all asking a lot of questions about it. Otherwise, I wouldn't say anything. Even though you didn't get it, there's another possible route that you can take that doesn't require out-of-pocket expenditures, and that's called energy performance contracting. You may not be large enough to merit the attention of those who are in that business. I did this for 20 years, so I know the business well. But basically, the concept is you bring in a third party called an energy services company or an ESCO. They do an audit. If you go forward, they go out and get the financing. It doesn't have to be town debt, but it counts against the town bond ceiling. They get the contractors, put the work in, guarantee the savings, and the debt is paid from the savings over a 10 to 15 year period. Many cities around the country, some in North Carolina, have done that. There's a process prescribed by state law for how a municipality does it. You have to go to a regulatory body in the treasurer's office to get it approved. But it is one route you can take. My only hesitation is I don't know that the size of the project is large enough to attract a performance contractor because you are relatively small. If it's only $90,000, you're definitely too small. But you sometimes can aggregate with somebody else, and or there may be more savings there than you've identified so far. But that's something that we can easily find a little bit more about, see whether we can get somebody to come and look and see if it's worth a company's while to examine that.
Can that be for houses, I mean, beyond government facilities?
There are four sectors that this ESCO market works in: municipalities, universities, schools, and hospitals. It theoretically could work on smaller buildings, but it's very difficult to do it because the transaction costs of one company to make a guarantee, do an audit, bring in all the contractors, monitor the savings, get government approval for all this is so large that even though we've tried to bring this to a lower, to a smaller building sector, it hasn't worked.
So it wouldn't apply to homes in Carrboro?
No, it would not apply to homes in Carrboro. There have been a few utility programs in the past where they did utilize that concept, and basically the utility paid for the savings that were delivered to homes. So the homes were sort of passive recipients of savings. The contractors went out and borrowed money and were paid for not by the homeowner but by the utility for the savings. And in fact, it's another point I wanted to make, because even though Randy mentioned that your focus is the commercial sector, and given that you have a revolving loan fund, that makes a fair amount of sense, there can and probably will be some residential customers in Carrboro that are affected to that, and that's partly due to what Chapel Hill has done in recruiting Duke to come and do a pilot in Orange County. There's 16,000 electrically heated households in Orange County, and those are going to be the recipient of the first ever Duke pilot to treat with contractors an audit and implementation of envelope measures, attic insulation, air sealing of ductwork, and so on, where Duke will pay up to $800 per household based on the kilowatt hours that are saved. And what we're doing in Chapel Hill, and we will encourage Carrboro to consider this as well, is we're going to increase the incentive levels so that other measures beyond envelope measures might be eligible. For example, hot water heaters, even water measures like low flush toilets, faucet aerators, and so on might be eligible. In addition, in Chapel Hill, there are probably going to be incentives for replacement heating and cooling systems to try to bring the homeowner who has to replace such a system anyway to pay the incremental cost of the most efficient, so that when somebody's replacing a system anyway, we get the most efficient, and that may be a way to do that. I want to back up and say a few words about the retrofit ramp up. It was quite an extraordinary program, even within the extraordinary set of measures in the ERA legislation passed last year. This is the only one of its kind from Washington in which they basically said, we're going to take $400 million and we're not going to make 100 awards like a formula grant. We're going to make 25 awards, so that these are relatively large awards. There were over 100 applicants from around the country that bid on this. My firm was involved in two of the successful. We're the only one involved in two. One is the Southeast Energy Efficiency Alliance, which we pretty much put together with the Southeast, and the other one's in the Greater Cincinnati, also an energy alliance. So they're very similar program models, and one of the reasons I bring that up is we're going to try to get economies of scale so that some of the common functions that every city has to do, we can borrow from what another community has done and lower the cost. Monitoring and verification is a relatively unwieldy cost that DOE requires, but if it's spread with the same information technology backbone, for example, among several cities, we can bring the cost to any particular city down. And in the award that the Southeast Energy Efficiency Alliance won in particular, which went to 10 cities, and by the way, we bid $62 million, got $20 million, so we had to cut everybody back. So it is a testament to Chapel Hill and Carrboro that you got as much money as you did, which is a reflection that there's a confidence in the Southeast Energy Alliance that you can spend that money well. And the way it works is every dollar of incentive that you spend in a customer's building, in a residential or commercial customer's building, you get that dollar back at the end of the first year into the second year to spend as you wish, and for future incentives or on staff or on marketing or if you, whatever else you want. Also, the Southeast is going to have a $1 million loan loss reserve attached to a financing program that will be available everywhere throughout the region, including Chapel Hill and Carrboro, and they will also make available some consultants to you at no cost, so that even though it's only $75,000, for example, for Carrboro, you're really getting a lot more of that from what the Southeast Energy Alliance is offering to everybody. So it's no-cost consultants, it's a financing program, it'll be region-wide, it's a marketing program, and there will be an M&V component, monitoring and verification, that will be that Chapel Hill and Carrboro will take advantage of. Another couple of words. The reason that Retrofit Ramp-Up made so few awards of a lot of money to a few cities is because they want to show that you can get significant building, to your point, Sammy, about trying to get significant penetration to meet these greenhouse gas goals. Well, the best utility program might get 1% participation in a year and might reduce kilowatt-hour usage by 0.5%, and usually that's less than kWh goes up every year because of increased loads. So that's why they did this program. They want to demonstrate that you can get significant penetration based on neighborhoods. So municipalities are not a focus of this themselves, their buildings, but their neighborhoods are. Durham has a similar program funded under a different program with their energy block grant money. And so the hope is in 2 years we can make enough headway to demonstrate that this kind of thing works, and the fact that we have a Speaker of the House in this neighborhood, that we have some state legislators, they're very active on this issue, that we have several communities with common interests, and not just Chapel Hill, but Greensboro, Durham, and Charlotte, all of which have, except for Durham, have are part of Retrofit Ramp-Up grants as well. We hope that we can demonstrate this success, get economies of scale, convince Duke to do more than they would do, but also convince the state legislature and the Public Service Commission that now that we've demonstrated it, we need a lot more work from the Public Service Commission to mandate larger levels of spending from the utilities and to create some state legislation to continue the momentum and perhaps to create an energy alliance type structure that we've seen now in Cincinnati, which now has a budget of a couple million, five staff people. Cambridge has three. We're doing this in the Virgin Islands. Come down and visit. And at other locations. You're a little too small to do this on your own with just Chapel Hill and Carrboro, but if you're successful in collaborating with Durham and with Greensboro and with Charlotte, this is something that could happen over time. So we view this as a two-year experiment to show that things can happen, that people will take loans connected to grants that will get on-bill financing eventually. It may not be PACE, it may be Duke, or there may be PACE in a year, or there may be Duke in a year. Those things tend to have a magnetic effect to get participation levels way up if you make it easy for people to access debt and if you make the debt very affordable and accessible. And so we are hopeful that before the end of the 2 years is over, we'll have other resources from Duke, other mandates from the state, and we know that there will be other community development programs that Chapel Hill will get and the state will get to distribute again to smaller communities. We just don't know how much money yet because it's 2 years from now. It's in next year's budget. So I'll stop there and see if you have any questions.
Actually, I do have some questions. The first question is, what kind of services would the consultants be providing?
Good question. There's several categories of consultants written into the budget. One is financing, and so you mentioned Jeff Hughes, I think, who does financings at the UNC Environment. He's one of the consultants that we can get. There's actually two routes to get consultants. One is through directly the SEIA grant, and another is through Oak Ridge and a separate DOE technical assistance grant, and we can get Jeff Hughes for free through Oak Ridge. So One of the things we talked about today in Chapel Hill is to make the request to get him so we can get his time. He can look at PACE. He can also look at an OWASA on-bill financing that would benefit both Chapel Hill and Carrboro. There's also marketing consultants.
Could you explain that OWASA stuff? I'm going to slow you down because I don't really do well with jargon. And,
sure.
And since it's kind of town participation, I want people to understand exactly what it means when the town's participating. So I'm going to ask you to go back just for a moment and talk about what would Mr. Hughes do? Would he be a consultant to the town or would he be a consultant to the businesses that might be applying for the revolving loan?
No, he'd be a consultant to the town or towns. He'd probably work for both Chapel Hill and Carrboro to look at the possibility of securing a add-on to your bill from OWASA that would treat not just water measures but water, electricity, gas, whatever. And to see, and we've had a preliminary, Chapel Hill has occasioned a preliminary meeting with OWASA. It went well, but it's just the beginning. It might not go well over time. It's never been done. Charleston, South Carolina has engaged a consultant to do that, and other cities, including Cincinnati, are looking at that same opportunity. Now, a person like Jeff Hughes is a very popular person right now because he knows PACE, he knows on-bill financing, and there aren't many people that has his expertise. So financing is one major category. Program design is another. That's what my firm does. Marketing strategy is a third. Workforce development is a fourth. Monitoring and verification is a fifth. So the town and Chapel Hill together singularly can go and request from either SEA or from Oak Ridge, or you can't for Oak Ridge because you're not a formula grant recipient, but Chapel Hill could on your behalf request for the Oak Ridge consultant.
Can we make
actually have a follow-up.
To do that?
Yeah, I do, but I have kind of a follow-up clarification question with him. In terms of the workforce development, which is kind of what I'm interested in, how much of that portion of the grant or even the larger grants are being used for that? I'm just curious.
Every city is a little different. I think, if I'm trying to remember this, I think it's $200,000 for the whole region for workforce development, so it's not a lot of money, but that doesn't include what an individual town could put in their own budget for it.
You do realize that every county government, except for maybe North Dakota, which is strange, is facing a lot of declining money. So when you talk about partnering with people, we're good with that. We do that now. But in terms of taking on more financing, that's really going to be a dead horse until the economy improves. I mean, I want to kind of put you in the real world to where Orange County is, where Chapel Hill is, and where we are in terms of we would have to raise taxes to provide more money to do that. So to quote Jackie, we'd be taking money from other people to be doing it, and sometimes we do that, but in this sort of economic environment, we're sort of looking for things that don't cost us any money, and I don't know about the rest of you, but I don't want to hear about us gathering any more financing.
Well, let me respond in three different parts to what you said.
Okay.
First part is the financing we're talking about will not cost the town of Carrboro or Chapel Hill a cent.
Okay.
The second part of it is people don't like to go into a debt. That's going to be a problem. I agree. And the third part of it is the idea of PACE and on-bill financing is to create something it's more accessible, easier to access the credit. That's why we have a loan loss reserve. And to create incentives on top of that, which would be part of what the Carrboro budget idea of a revolving loan would be, so that you can get 3 or 4% money and not 10 or 11% money. Having said all that, I agree with your first point, which is it's very hard to get people to take debt. People think that having a creative loan financing problem is the answer. It isn't the answer. You have to have a program design. You have to have a marketing. You have to have the workforce qualified. You have to have a lot of things in sync before even the best of financing programs work. So I agree with the general point that in a recession, it's very hard for lenders to be willing to lend money and for borrowers to borrow money.
Sammy, you had a question?
Just to clarify, at least with PACE, if we were ever to do that, for people who are hearing, that's an opt-in debt that they would take on, I guess, as with the revolving loan fund. The trick there is, of course, the seed money, and that's
right.
Where we would get that. I just wanted to make a motion. I'd hope for us to see about approaching Chapel Hill or however it may be possible to have Jeff Hughes consult for us.
I'll second that.
Or maybe we should ask Randy if that's already.
Or is that already done, Randy?
I'm thinking, before we do that, don't we need to accept attachment A?
Oh, I don't know the order.
There's not an order, but we can do that.
Corey, I have some questions of if I would prefer to refer it to staff to determine if that's what we want to do before we make that, I mean, that kind of decision, because we...
It's free, though.
And I know it's free, but...
And no, that's what attachment A does, really, right. Is refer it to.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Right.
Well, then that's fine.
Okay.
And it sounds like he's being wanted badly from all corners of the world. So the quicker we can do it, the better.
So, well, just procedurally, I would just rather we accept attachment A or...
So moved.
Second.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed? Nay. Okay. So, none. So, Sammy, go ahead. So you want
to... I just wanted to make a motion for to see if staff could look into, if we could see about getting some consulting help from Jeff Hughes.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
None opposed? Okay. The matter passes. So, I had one question about the alternate route or the other route that you described, the energy service.
Energy performance contract.
You're right, energy performance. And I'm just wondering if you said that that sounded kind of creative, open-ended in terms of how you work with utilities. And I'm wondering if with that, are there any solar plans that have been worked through that kind of?
Yes. Oftentimes, that's one of the motivations why communities go out to bid, mm-hmm. so that they can basically write down the payback period for photovoltaics, which is typically 25 to 40 years. Mm-hmm. But if you combine that with lower cost, quicker payback measures like replacing that lighting, like water measures, controls measures. You can then combine those in a package, and the whole set of measures, including the PV, photovoltaic, can be financed in a period of 12 to 15 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's something I'd like us to be able to look into. We had talked, I don't know, almost a year ago about creating some potential third party to look at creating solar arrays that the town could offset.
Yeah, costs. There's also something called power purchase agreements, which is a way to work with a local utility to make it likely, to make it easier to finance over a period of time and actually bring in third-party providers so they can take all the tax credits because the city can't take tax credits. Unfortunately, state law precludes that at the moment, but Winston-Salem, Raleigh, and another community, I can't remember what the third one was, might have been Charlotte, got a state law passed on their behalf to let those three have the opportunity to do power purchase agreements with their utility.
That sounds like something we need to work on.
Yeah, maybe we should look into getting onto that bill.
Would someone put that forth?
Can we
That's
make
probably
a motion?
Too late for this year, but we need to get it on legislative agenda. Is that current legislation, or is that already?
It was passed about a year ago or 2 years ago, and it's on Chapel Hill's list, so it's a good thing to add.
Okay.
So let's make a motion to add looking into joining in that special bill.
Unless that's the thing we already joined.
No.
No, this is for power purchase agreement.
Okay.
Yeah, they're also going back to as you mentioned, to remedy the PACE legislation, make it a little easier to work with.
So I make a motion for staff to look into, in a year, I guess, to be a part of that special bill.
Let's not put the year on it, because
Or sooner, yeah.
Yeah,
right.
So it's going to be a year, because they're going to be, this is a short session.
Steve,
well,
you look like you want to say.
Like,
no, I was just saying, I mean, if it requires special legislation, it'd have to be next year or after. It can be this year.
Well, right.
Because even if there was a bill this year, it would be too late for us to get added to it.
Right.
Is that right?
But we would want staff to
that was a question.
Be looking
is that right?
At it.
Does anyone know?
E-banking is certainly too late to introduce legislation, but I think it would have to be
Well, I don't know what the feedback, you know, there is that bill circulating for Carrboro and Chapel Hill, but I don't know.
We can say ASAP.
Yeah, if we could piggy, especially because it's not an, you know, it's not an original thing. It's
right.
Just, can we do it too?
Can we use that template?
Or can we just be added to the existing municipalities that are allowed to use it?
What is the name of it?
To power purchasing.
Mike, correct me if I'm wrong, but if I don't think there's any way in the short session to be added to legislation that's already been adopted. If there's a bill floating around that covers us, maybe there's a way.
I mean, we couldn't afford to go out and purchase the panels right now anyway. So.
Yeah, but.
Well, with power purchase agreements, somebody else puts the money up.
That's like third entity.
Okay.
Right. Right.
That's really too bad.
We can always afford for someone else to put the money up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where were you, Steve, a year ago? We were racking our brains. Well, but, you know, I agree with Sammy. I'd really like to see us look into this. And
so does someone want to second that?
I'll second. Second. Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Matter passes unanimously.
I had another question for you. I understand community-supported energy is something difficult to do in the state because you have to be a utility for the distribution lines. Is it hard to be a utility?
It is, and not just this state, but almost every state, because the investor-owned utilities take it very seriously. If you even try to have a combined heat and power and try to cross the street with it, that's why UNC would have difficulty selling the town its SS power, because they'd have to be treated as a regulated utility, and it would cost so much money to go through that. They wouldn't do it. There's a lot of people around the country trying to change that everywhere, but it hasn't succeeded yet. If you deregulate the utilities in a state, it makes it easier to
not deregulate. Make them
okay. Well, thank you, Steve. Are there any other questions for Steve?
Good luck.
Thanks very much.
Thank you so much, and thank you for waiting. I had one other matter. Matters from town clerk, manager, attorney. Earlier this evening, Dan had asked for a report, and we all kind of, you know, went silent. And I, you know, I it was a police stopping folks. And I kind of, you know, usually when a board member asks for a report, it, you know, we never kind of let it fall on deaf ears. So I would really like to see us follow through on Dan's request.
Can I speak to that? Sure. I've been stopped. We've all gone through a checkpoint, and I've been stopped at the corner of Morningside and Spring Valley. And twice, because I had to go to the grocery store, and they asked for my registration and driver's license then, and they asked for it on my way back. I didn't think, oh, I should avoid it by going on Blue Ridge. I just drove back. I don't find them, strangely enough, because when people complain about speeding in their neighborhoods, typically they pick a random day, they don't announce it, so people can slow down, and they get stopped. I don't think they target anybody. Strangely enough, coming from a former criminal defense attorney who still believes in the Fourth and Fifth and Sixth Amendments and the Eighth Amendment, it's an annoyance, but it's part of what they do.
You don't think we should understand why they do it?
I don't think we have to have a board thing. I think you could probably call.
If I could interject for a minute, we recently actually sent this very information out, and I made a note to send it out again that goes into some detail, because it was a question that Sammy had raised about these kind of stops, and so it goes into detail about the why and how it's done. So we're happy to send it out again.
And that was more broad than just the, because I remember we had something about the question whether there was discrimination involved.
That was
because that question was raised.
But it was checkpoints, exactly what the issue that you raised.
Right.
And it talks about the process of why and how it's done internally.
Okay. Well, that'll be fine.
It's just sending it out again.
Yeah.
Okay.
The same one Joel's talking about.
And the same one I get stopped at.
Okay. I'm not having an issue with it. I just want to understand what it does for the community, because it's really you know, for most citizens, it might be the only time all year they interact directly with a police officer, and it would be good to understand the benefit of that interaction. So,
yeah, and since you asked, yes.
Good.
Thanks, Randy.
Anything else?
You know, years ago, I had complained about speeding in Bowling Forest, and one night I was coming home from a meeting and going down the entrance road, and so I pull over, and the officer says, you know, Alderman, somebody's been complaining about speeders in your neighborhood, so I've been sitting here all evening. Do you know how fast you were going?
There you go.
I do have another thing. I would like, between now and our last meeting, an update of where we are with the banking issue and the proposed timeline.
Well, you all gave us a timeline, and our plan is to meet it.
Okay. So that is...
The first meeting back in August.
And that would mean implementation fairly soon after that?
That would be the plan.
Okay.
I mean, it's going to take a matter of weeks just to do the paperwork and everything, but okay. I will point out that just recently, Nancy Infley, our accounting officer, has been working with Harrington Bank. We actually have moved $1 million to Harrington Bank in a short-term CD investment, okay, which we're now able to do because they're an official depository that we hadn't been able to do before.
Great.
So even in advance of the banking services contract, we're doing some business with them.
Thanks, Steve.
Good.
Thank you.
All right. There's nothing else. This meeting is adjourned.
Good job, man.
All right.